Yeah, so if I was in India, we'd start the talk by saying Namo Buddhaya Jai Bhim. So today is the 125th birthday of Dr. Ambedkar. And that's why I'm wearing this very subtle rosette with a little picture of Dr. Ambedkar in it. Apparently today the whole of Nagpur city is wearing blue.
No.
Pretty much. Nagpur is almost a Buddhist city. And, you know, large Buddhist areas at least. And they're all out celebrating today, or it's now the evening, so they'll hopefully be going to bed. But they're all wearing blue, and that's the colour that the Indian Buddhists usually wear on kind of classes and sort of Buddhist occasions. So I wanted to just, what we'll do this evening is I'll give a small kind of presentation or talk about Dr. Ambedkar, and then we could have a time for questions and answers. And then we'll do maybe an Indian style, well, we will do an Indian style ritual. I'll see how we go for time, what that will consist of at the end. But first of all, I just wanted to ask you, if you were thinking about it, who are the world's great reformers? Have a think about that. If you were to put your mind to it, who are the world's great reformers who've really made a difference to world history?
Gandhi.
Mandela, yeah.
Martin Luther King,
yeah. Would anyone think of saying Dr. Ambedkar at that point?
Well, definitely.
I would.
Yeah. He's getting more publicity, I notice, in the media generally over the last few years.
Yeah. So he is becoming more well known. Even Google had him as their little Google, whatever that's called, little typeface at the top. So, yes, he is becoming more popular. But, you know, he's not a particular sort of charismatic or well-known figure in the West. But if you go to India, and particularly amongst the Indian Buddhists, if you say to them, you know, who are the world's great reformers, or we had this convention and we were asked all to discuss who's the person who's inspired you the most, and they look at you as if you're completely mad that you would even ask such a question, and they say, well, of course, Baba Saheb Ambedkar, like, who else, you know? And if you go to India, particularly in the more Buddhist areas, you'll see his picture everywhere, and the statues, particularly around Nagpur, I must say, and in Pune. So you can see he's, I've put a picture of him on the shrine. He's not the kind of usual Indian great world reformer that you might have in mind. He's wearing a Western suit, usually. He was quite a tall man, sort of fairly portly, and wearing very characteristic glasses. And the glasses are the kind of caricature now of Dr. Ambedkar. I've noticed on Indian TV when they're sort of putting, they do this kind of scribble, which is a face of Dr. Ambedkar, and it starts with the glasses. So that's become his distinguishing feature. And what you see of Dr. Ambedkar is this figure who looks, as in that picture, he's got that kind of very, very intense look, a man of great conviction. I always think some sadness too. It's almost like he's, you know, he's experienced so much in life and knows how far he has to go. And he's got that real kind of determination and grit to get there. He's called Bhimrao. He was called Bhimrao Ambedkar. Bhim meaning formidable, meaning strong, or like a kind of warrior or fearless. And Sangharakshita says of him, he was a formidable man. He was someone you don't take lightly. So you could imagine one of our centres in India. You could imagine a tiny, rather hot room in a block of flats, or another tiny hot room in a in a shopping centre in central Nagpur, or a tin-roofed concrete structure, quite big in a kind of field, or a bamboo marquee, again in a scrubby field. Michelle's been to that one in Bodh Gaya. You could even imagine one of our Buddhist centres in a complex of very well-maintained brick buildings, which houses a further educational establishment for people from disadvantaged backgrounds, young people from disadvantaged backgrounds. Or a tin-roofed, open-side shelter in Mumbai, down a kind of back street somewhere. And when you go to a centre there, the first thing that happens is there's the offering of flowers. So you offer a garland to Babasaheb Ambedkar's picture. You offer a flower to the picture of Sangharakshita, and then flowers are given to you and anyone who's kind of joined in from elsewhere. I'm not quite sure sometimes who's getting a flower, but it's actually a very, very beautiful way to start a class. You know, you're given flowers. You're introduced, and they have a short puja, then a talk. And then eventually, when things have kind of got going, what I found is that you start to hear people's stories. And hear things about people's lives. So within most of the people who come, not all the people who come, but most of the people who come are from the Dalit community. Dalit meaning oppressed. And it's the community of people that were formerly known as untouchable within the Hindu caste system. And sometimes you hear these kind of big stories of really terrible violence, and you might see them on the news. Some of them come over here, not all of them, but sometimes you might hear some of these stories of terrible violence. But actually it's the everyday stories of kind of insidious undermining, the denial of basic human rights to education, to even religion, to water, to land. There's a kind of little stories of being refused access in some way. So, for example, you know, you're not allowed to play games in the as in school with the other children because you're of a lower caste, or you're not allowed to hand money to the shopkeeper. You have to throw it on the floor, and he'll pick it up from the floor, but he won't take it from your hands. Or you're denied maybe learning an instrument because you're from a lower caste and they'll only teach a Brahmin. So there's things like this, just everyday little stories. People practicing under sometimes quite difficult circumstances. And I often speak to women, more women than men, and you know, they've told me stories about coming to a class, and when they've come home at the Buddhist centre, and when they've come home, their husband's family have locked them out of the building because they didn't cook lunch, so they've been locked out, which is actually very unsafe for a woman in India. Or even sometimes people are beaten, women are beaten for going on retreat. So you hear these kind of big stories and little stories, but everywhere underlying it you see that actually something's going on that's just not right. But at the same time as all those kind of stories, what you also see is this incredible positivity and joy actually in centres there. And maybe it starts with the colours of the saris. I do love going to India and the colours of the saris. It's such a great kind of country that you can just go around in completely shocking pink from head to toe. That's brilliant. And there's this wonderful sense that we can change things. You know, there's things that are difficult, there's things that are hard, but we can do something about it, and we will. And it does not matter how much money we've got or how much oppression we face, we're going to do something. And I tell you, that enthusiasm is totally infectious. I think that's why Westerners often really love going to India, because there's this sense of possibility. You know, in a sense, we don't experience their kind of what they experience in terms of the difficulties. But actually, what we also sometimes don't experience is that level of kind of initiative and positivity, that kind of fighting spirit. And one thing I would say that definitely characterises our Buddhist community in India is a sense of dignity. People are incredibly dignified and positive. And with this sense of the possibility that we can do anything. There's my favourite team, what I call my favourite team in India, who are a group of friends who decided that they were going to run retreats. So they decided they were going to run a retreat for 4,000 people. And they didn't have any money. I mean, they really don't have a bean to their name. And they decided they were just going to do it. They weren't going to ask for any money from the West. They were just going to fundraise it all themselves. And when they'd done that, which they did do, which it kind of involved creating a whole city for a retreat, when they did that, they decided that they needed a Buddhist arts festival to celebrate Buddhist arts, and that it should be high quality with a good kind of brochure and really good sound systems. And they were going to do that as well, even though they didn't have any money. And they did. It just kind of happened. So there's that kind of initiative as well. And what unites all those people? Well, what unites them is Dr. Ambedkar and the incredible inspiration that they have from this figure, Dr. Ambedkar. So they will say of themselves, well, I'm a son of Babasaheb Ambedkar. I'm a daughter of Babasaheb. Anything is possible. Anything. So who was Dr. Ambedkar? Well, he himself was born into untouchability. So just to say a bit about the caste system. Within the caste system, you have a kind of what he called a system of graded inequality, where the society is divided into castes, with the Brahmins at the top and the Shudras at the bottom, and all sorts of castes in between. And the untouchables were even below the Shudras. They were not allowed to be touched by any other higher caste. Because their touch was seen as polluting. And once you're born into a caste, you can't get out of it. So you have to do the same profession as your family has traditionally undertaken. So whether that's dealing in human excrement or sifting through rubbish or looking after animals, whatever it is, that's what you're going to be doing in your life. It determines your job, who you marry, who you're friends with, where you can walk, where you can get your water, whether you can get an education or own land or go to the temple, even what you can eat. So Dr. Ambedkar was born into that society, but he did have one advantage, which was that his father was in the British Army. And because his father was in the army, he got a right to education. So this is where the whole system started to change. And it has changed a lot since then. It was starting to move even at that time. But the fact that he gained an education really, really changed something for him. So he was the first Dalit to complete his higher education. And he got a sponsorship from the Maharaja of Baroda, who was a very forward-thinking man. And through that sponsorship, he managed to get an MA and PhD in economics in Columbia University. He also managed, a little bit later, to get an MA and PhD in economics at the London School of Economics. And he was called to the bar because he studied at Gray's Inn in London. He was a barrister at law. So he was a very dedicated man, particularly, you know, to his education at that time. Apparently he used to get up at 2 o'clock in the morning to work and to study for his exams. And basically he could have had a really great life. He could have settled in the US or in the UK. People wouldn't have treated him as an untouchable. They would have... You know, he had a fantastic education. But he had a burning problem. He had something on his mind, which was this quest to end untouchability in India. And he tried various means to do that. So he tried political, economic and social strategies to end untouchability. So just to give you a few sort of well-known example, one of the things he did in terms of social action was... In 1927, he he led a group of his followers to go and drink at a particular reservoir, Chowder Tank, as it's called. And in 1927, so traditionally, the people from his caste, the Dalits, would not be able to drink from that reservoir because their touch of the water would be polluting. So they weren't allowed to drink there. But in 1927, the local municipality opened it up to all castes. So he went with his followers to drink from that reservoir. So very, very simple action. They all just went there. They just drank from their hands and then they left. But this was totally revolutionary because they were drinking from the same water source as the higher castes. And it provoked a very violent response from the higher caste Hindus. They regarded their water as having been polluted by the untouchables, as they called them. And of course, how does one purify the water that's been touched by your fellow man? You purify it by putting in 108 pots of yogurt, milk, cow dung, and cow urine. So this is the very bizarre Hindu system that is very hard for us to understand. You know, that actually a human being drinking from the same water source is regarded as more polluting than cow urine and dung. And I think, you know, that was a very shocking, shocking thing to happen. He also tried, I mean, he had two PhDs in economics, so he tried also economic action. He established the Finance Commission of Independent India, and he helped establish the Reserve Bank. He created, in law, reservations of jobs in the government sector, so that a certain, which is still in place, that a certain number of government jobs have to go to Dalits. And he tried many political avenues, so he founded various political organisations. He became chair of the board that drafted the Constitution of India, which is based on principles of the Dharma. It's actually a really wonderful constitution, the Constitution of India. He became the law minister of the first government of independent India. And the kind of critical moment was when he was the law minister, he tried to bring through Parliament something called the Hindu Code Bill. And the Hindu Code Bill was trying to change some of the most oppressive aspects of Hindu law, particularly in relation to women. And he just met with a block. And he could see that actually, I mean, originally what he wanted was the Hindus to treat the Dalits with respect and courtesy and to change the system from the inside, as it were. He realised they just weren't going to change. They just weren't going to give up some of those really terrible things that were just such an important part of their kind of culture and part of Hindu law. So this precipitated an internal crisis. He said, you know, we've got this wonderful constitution, and he saw that he could bring in positive change by law to a certain extent, but with the social problems in India, with their attitude to caste and their attitude to women, it was a palace on a dung heap, as he called it. The constitution of India was a palace on a dung heap. And he realised that he needed more. He needed more than a political solution. He said, history bears out the proposition that political revolutions have always been preceded by social and religious revolutions. The emancipation of the mind and the soul is a necessary preliminary for the political expansion of a people. So he realised that they needed a change of mind and soul if anything was going to change. And what he was looking for was a free and just society, and he saw that law can't really get to the bottom of the problem. It can help. It can enable something to happen, but only if the conditions are right. He realised that actually law, the rule of law, only can influence a certain number of people at any time. You've only got a certain number of policemen. You've only got a certain number of officials putting things in place. And, you know, great parts of India just aren't even under government control. It's a huge country. But and law can't change everything. It can't change a whole society's attitude. People will always abuse the system, and it will come back in different forms. And we're seeing this really now again in India, unfortunately. Things have become much worse in India recently in terms of the caste system. And we can see that in our own society too. You know, law does a certain amount, but underneath the surface, if you don't change people's minds, oppression and violence will come back. So we're seeing now the rise of nationalism and fundamentalism and extremism. You know, even in a country like America, which is, you know, a world-leading country, you can have someone like Obama, the President of the United States, who I personally think has got a lot of integrity, actually. And he can do a certain amount. But then underneath the surface, there's Donald Trump and his followers waiting to pop out. And the problem is that when you've got a divided consciousness, you'll always look for someone to blame. You know, so now it's the Muslims, but before it was the Jews. And you're always going to try and blame the minority and the oppressed. You're going to look for someone, yeah, to blame for all your uncertainty, and particularly economic uncertainty. And hatred will find a kind of way to come out in society. So you need more than law to stop that. You need a society based in moral principles. So Dr. Ambedkar had quite a subtle understanding, actually, of what morality was. He said that moral principles are based in maitri, which he called also fraternity. So he said fraternity is based in maitri, or metta, as we would understand it, loving kindness. Loving kindness is the foundation of fraternity. So he called fraternity a primarily a mode of associated living, of conjoint communicated experience. It is essentially an attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men. So he said that's what morality is. That's what you need as the bedrock of society. Because if you have that attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men, out of that metta or maitri, flow the principles of liberty and equality. And he said that he got his values of liberty, equality and fraternity not from the French Revolution, but from my master, the Buddha. So he had this vision of democracy. He had a vision of a pure land, a Prabuddha Bharat, which is based on democratic values. And he said, democracy is more than a political machine or a form of government. It is even more than a social system. It is an attitude of mind or a philosophy of life. So that's what he wanted society to be based on. He wanted to be based on the principles of maitri, democracy, fraternity. And he realised that in order to really imbue society with those values, to change the attitude of society, people in the society, what you needed was religion. So he looked around to all the world's religions, and all the world's religions certainly came to him, and some of them offered him quite a large sum of money if he would convert to their religion. But he chose Buddhism. He wrote a very interesting paper, by the way, saying why he chose Buddhism, called The Buddha and the Future of His Religion. And he chose Buddhism because Buddhism teaches those values: maitri, metta, fraternity, liberty, equality, and democracy. And that Buddhism teaches them not as rules, but actually teaches you how to transform your mind so that those kind of qualities come from the inside. They come from your mind, your attitude to life, not from externally imposed rules. He said, religion must be a matter of principles only. It cannot be a matter of rules. The moment it degenerates into rules, it ceases to be religion, as it kills the responsibility which is the essence of a truly religious act. So it's quite important, actually. That's quite a thing to understand about religion, that religion has to be have as its essence responsibility. And responsibility is the essence of any truly religious act. You can't impose it from the outside. You have to kind of imbue those qualities from the inside. And he was very, very keen to stress the importance of personal responsibility. His followers loved him. They would have really done anything that he said. And one thing he constantly stressed was the need for personal responsibility, to take your own choices in life. And he saw that, Buddhism is about transforming the mind. It's about transforming the mind, which then influences society. In fact, it's the only thing that can transform society. And he said that the Buddhist religion is nothing if not morality. What God is to other religions, morality is to Buddhism. So after a lifetime of interest, and it's clear he did have a lifetime of interest, he embraced Buddhism in 1956 with 380,000 of his followers, and then more in the coming days also embraced Buddhism. And it's interesting that in all this social injustice that he faced and the fights in society that he faced, he saw society as serving the development of mind. And he kept that vision. He saw that actually what he wanted to achieve was cultivating higher values that change society. He says, although society is necessary for the individual, mere social welfare cannot be the ultimate goal of religion. According to me, individual development should be the real aim of religion. So he wasn't just saying, I'm going to adopt... Sometimes he's accused of adopting Buddhism as a political stunt. But he really wasn't doing that as a political stunt. He realised that actually Buddhism wasn't just for society. It was more that actually the society is there to help develop the spiritual development of the individual. Help cultivate the spiritual development of the individual. And it's quite an interesting thing to reflect on, because it leaves the question open. What is progress? You know, is progress improving a kind of just society? Or is it materialistic development, enabling someone to have more economic power? Or is it developing people of good character? Is it about personal transformation? And that's what interests me about Dr. Ambedkar. He wasn't just saying, well, no, my people have been impressed, they need to just amass wealth and own land like everybody else. He was saying something more subtle. He was saying that individual transformation and the transformation of society come together, and that society is there for the development of mind. So this is the kind of message that he gave his followers, and it worked. So the people who did embrace Buddhism, the Buddhist Dalits, have done much better than any other group in India, even of Dalits. So you can see that in the figures. In this, I've only got the figures for the 2011 national census, but it's clear from that Buddhist Dalits have the highest literacy rate of any group, including male and female literacy. They've got highest work participation rate, and most equal sex ratio of 0 to 6-year-olds. So what that means is that there's not a female infanticide, which is an interesting figure, actually. The ratio is what it should be. But it's not so much about statistics. It's about human experience. It's about dignity and respect. It's about the fact that people are no longer untouchable. They realise that they're capable of the best, both educationally and spiritually. He had a motto, Dr. Ambedkar, which was educate, agitate and organise. And people did. They educated themselves, sometimes under huge personal cost. They agitated and they organised. They found out, you know, what provisions had been made for them in law, and they really benefited from those systems. And there was a transformation, there has been a transformation in one generation, but it's really only in one proportion of the population, the people who really, really took up Buddhism under Dr. Ambedkar. It's not every single Dalit by any means. So why is he important for us? Well, he's important for us because he shows us something. He shows us that change is possible by spiritual means. He undertook a completely peaceful revolution. In fact, it was so peaceful that most people don't know about it. And he managed to transform millions of people's lives in one generation. And, you know, I could tell you story among story and story and story about the kind of transformations that did go on. And this is significant in the world stage because this is what we need. We need a peaceful revolution, a revolution of the transformation of mind, which also transforms society. And it challenges the expectation of religion being a private affair, because particularly in the West, we tend to think of religion as something that we might do of an evening, but we won't necessarily tell people what we're doing. Because it's not really anyone else's business. And we'll carry on with what we're doing in life, and, you know, religion will just stay as that kind of little personal thing we do on a Thursday evening or something like that. Mm. So Dr. Ambedkar stretches us. He stretches us to think, actually, we've got something precious. It's precious to us. It's transformed our own mind, and that's significant. Because it means that it can have an impact on society too. We need that message, because we also have the gravitational pull of individualism. And I think this is just on the rise, particularly when it encounters negative forces. So, you know, if you read the news and you see some of the shocking things that happen and the rise of intolerance and bigotry, it's very easy to just retreat into a private world where there's good people in this world, you know. Well, I would say we're all good people, and we can retreat into a kind of community with each other and not really face those broader issues. I was listening to a talk from Sangharakshita about his reminiscences on Dr. Ambedkar, and he said, well, in the West, we approach the spiritual life from the psychological, so we move from the psychological to the spiritual. He said in India, they tend to move from the social to the spiritual. And he said, in a way, you need both. You need the transformation of mind and the transformation of society. He said, you know, perhaps, although perhaps we've got more to learn from the Indians than maybe they have from us. He said, I don't really think they need to learn how to look so much at their psychological problems. But we definitely need to learn how to think in terms of society much more. One of the things that Dr. Ambedkar said, very controversially, he said that the Buddhists must realise that it's their duty not just to be a good Buddhist, but to spread Buddhism. And he said, they must believe that to spread Buddhism is to serve mankind. And that's quite a challenge. It's quite a challenge for a Westerner, because it brings up images of people in funny clothes handing out leaflets on street corners and hassling you, you know. But actually, he wasn't talking about that. He was talking about actually making available the teachings that you've benefited from to other people, and really encouraging other people to make use of them as well. And Dr. Ambedkar's vision was not just for India. I have to say I find that tremendously exciting. He thought this was a message for the whole world, that Buddhism was of benefit to the whole world and had a part to play in entering a new phase of history. Because we're at a point in history where we have a choice. We can either have a world based on greed, hatred and delusion, or a world based on contentment, love and wisdom. Sangharakshita said, planet Earth has a really wonderful opportunity, but it's in at the same time quite a terrible position. We can either have one world spiritually at least, or no world. The choice is before us. So there we have this choice between no world or one world spiritually. And I think, you know, this is becoming more and more true, particularly with the seriousness of the situation with the environment. We have a choice which values we're going to live out and embody in our behaviour in society. And no one knows which way it will go. My father's a journalist and he's written a number of books. So he wrote a book in the 70s about the key issue, which was oil. And he wrote a book in the 80s about the key issue, which was the financial revolution. And he wants to write another book, but he said, I don't know which way, I don't know what the crucial sort of situation is. I don't know what is the main issue here. And he said that the thing is that the world is changing so quickly, you could write a book about the kind of crucial issue and it would be out of date by the time it comes into print. Like, no one knows. It's actually quite an exciting time. People are seeing that neoliberal capitalism doesn't quite work and they don't really know where they're going to go next. So I think Dr. Ambedkar's vision of the importance of Buddhism in that is something really worth reflecting on. And so there's that. There's the whole kind of world picture, but there's also the picture of India. So there's much more work to do to revive Buddhism in the land of its birth. There's 10 million Buddhists in India, and most are eager to learn more about Buddhism, but they don't have instruction or meditation or the Dharma. And we're in a position to give them some help with that. They're not really taking full advantage of what being a Buddhist means, which means they're not benefiting spiritually or economically from Buddhism in the way that they could. They can't take full advantage of the path they have chosen, and particularly outside Maharashtra. So we could help them, we could give more to revive Buddhism in the land of its birth. And we're in a unique position to do that because we're in a position to give that help because we've got a form of Buddhism that works in that context. And the form of Buddhism that we have is a real living practicing Sangha. So this really ties into Dr. Ambedkar's idea about what a Sangha should be. He had quite a particular vision of the Sangha. He said that the Sangha should be an example of living a true Buddhist life. It should be a model for society. Free to do service to the people. So he had this vision of the Sangha being educated, skilled or sort of learned in the old-fashioned sense of the world. Upright men and women who can offer true and impartial guidance to others, who are ethically responsible, aware and positive and living in harmony with one another and practicing wholeheartedly and giving to others. So that was his vision of the Sangha, and actually that's very close to Sangharakshita's vision of the Sangha. And what we see in India is that the Sangha in India has that to offer. So what they've got is they've got people who can serve their society, who practice wholeheartedly, who embody dignity and respect and can be leaders to others. And what I've noticed is that the Sangha in India transforms activists into friends, or what we would call Kalyana Mitras. And what I've seen